Murray cod, not only does it not grow anywhere else in the world, it doesn't even grow anywhere else in Australia. It only grows in the Murray-Darling Basin. Land-based aquaculture is a great system of production. I've been in agribusiness for 30 years and it's probably the best agribusiness I've ever seen.
Welcome to Nourishing Matters to Chew On. I'm Anthea Fawcett. Join me on a journey across our food and agricultural landscapes as I speak with inspiring people who are tackling parts of the wicked puzzle to enable change toward a healthier, more sustainable, fair and resilient food system and environment. I acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which this podcast is recorded throughout Australia and recognise their continuing connections to land, water and culture. I acknowledge that sovereignty has never been ceded and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Who doesn't love clean, green, delicious fish like Tasmanian Atlantic salmon, a hugely popular go-to protein for so many Australians? That was until Richard Flanagan's powerful book, Toxic, The Rotting Underbelly of the Tasmanian Salmon Industry, published in 2021, told the story of big problems with the industry and the negative impacts on the environment of salmon produced in large-scale industrial aquaculture in Tasmania's once pristine precious oceans. Flanagan's Toxic is a heart and environmentally wrenching story, but it isn't all bad news. In a webinar he presented about the issues, he shone light on where there's hope and great potential, that is, to expand sustainable, vertically integrated, closed-loop land-based aquaculture. In this episode, I'm really excited to be speaking with Ross Anderson about the inspiring story of Acuna Sustainable Murray Cod. Acuna is an award-winning land-based producer of Murray Cod, one of the most ancient, delicious and highly revered fish, once prolific in the wild, now listed as nationally threatened in 2003, and of course so special to Australia's First Peoples and the Murray-Darling Basin ecosystems. Welcome, Ross, and thank you so much for joining me on Nourishing Matters.
Thank you, Anthea. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ross, you're the chair of Acuna Sustainable Murray Cod and possess deep commercial experience in agribusiness and capital markets, both as an accountant and other roles that have included president of the MF Global Client Support Group in Australia, I understand. Ross, can you tell me about how did you first get to know about and get involved with Acuna, and what most excites you about what it does and the amazing fish it produces?
Look, it's an absolutely fabulous business in the sense that, I suppose I'll take you back to what got me started in it. What got me started in it was there was a very clever young man by the name of Matthew Ryan, who's now our managing director, who did an agronomy degree at university, came back and managed his family farm after his father's untimely death. And after about 10 or 15 years of that, he decided he didn't want to be in the commodity business. He was growing wheat and he really wanted to move into something where he felt there was shrinking supply and growing demand. And he said to me, he said, I'm going to start a fish farm. And he began with a small block out at Bilbil, just near De Bortley Wines outside Griffiths. And he began attempting to grow Murray cod. And through sort of some really solid scientific due diligence and a few accidental discoveries which led him on his way, which is how science tends to operate, he developed a method of growing these really clean, beautiful fish in a sustainable way that was quite good to replicate. You know, it was perfect for this region. The fish are a native species. They tasted delicious. And actually what got me involved with it was in about 2015 or 16, I was sitting in a local restaurant and I ordered the local Murray cod to eat. And I was blown away by the rich, creamy, gelatinous flavour of it and how good it was. And I said, and being a bit of a foodie who's travelled the world and eaten in good restaurants all over the place, I was really excited by it. And I went out to see Matt and Roger Cummins, who had also become involved, who's a local agricultural entrepreneur, and had a look at what they were doing with it and how they were beginning to form the fledgling of an industry, if you like. And so I got involved with them and we took a former gold mining company, which hadn't discovered any gold, and it happened to purchase the the grow-out farm of Matt Ryan, called Riverina Aquaculture. It purchased Bidgie Fresh, which was a nursery system designed for growing small Murray cod into larger ones to go out to the ponds, and a hatchery. We said, well, it's not much use doing this unless we're fully integrated and we can have full traceability for our customers. So we purchased the hatchery, the nursery, and the grow-out farm, and we listed it on the Australian Stock Exchange in January of 2017. So we've been going a bit over 5 years, and we've moved from startup to adolescence, if you like. We branded our fish Akuna, which means flowing waters in the local Indigenous language. We spelt it with a Q to signify that through technology and innovation, you actually get a better tasting product than you could get if you caught one in the wild. And we put four guiding principles around how this company would operate. And those four guiding principles are really the things that we refer to in every decision we make about how we operate the business. The first one is quality. You know, we know it's a beautiful product to eat. You know, the records of Major Mitchell going down the river when he was on his first expedition through the country and surviving on Murray cod, saying what a beautiful fish it was. There are records of, you know, hundreds of tons being, when the railheads opened in Victoria, hundreds of tons of Murray cod being shipped down to the Melbourne, particularly during winter when nobody wanted to go fishing on a sailboat in the middle of Bass Strait in winter. The Murray cod were a very easy target, and so as a result, they began to become a bit endangered. So sustainability is a second principle which guides our company, from the fact that we've released 23 million native fish back into the river system for restocking rivers and ponds, from the fact that we use our nutrient-enriched water to irrigate crops and pastures on the adjoining fields, and the fact that, you know, from an environmental protection aspect, we have fully contained systems. So no wastewater ever leaves our property. No disease could ever, you know, no wastewater ever gets anywhere near a native waterway or could infect anything else. And because of the small closed systems we have with the ponds, we're able to control the water quality quite well. You know, it's not like being in a large river or a large ocean where it's impossible to impact the water quality. We're able to manipulate that quite carefully.
And you have to be responsible for what you put in because you've got to get it out.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, and that comes to another one of the factors of our company is about integrity. And product integrity is really important to us. So when you eat your fish, you know, at Key Restaurant or Aria or somewhere, Tetsuya's, which all those guys have had it on their menus at different times, and I think some of them have it now, you can have complete confidence that we could tell you who the fish's mother and father is, what's been in the water, how it's been treated, what it's been fed from the day it's hatched until the day it hits your dinner plate. We've got complete traceability on that fish. There are aspects of our product integrity that we want to tighten up, particularly around the feed. You know, we're certainly not perfect yet, but our aim is to have it really, really in the situation where we can tell you every aspect of how that fish is treated, how it lives, what it's fed, right down to the enzymes and the food that's going into it. And the last aspect that, you know, the last principle that we work on is innovation. And this, to me, was one of the things that got me started, really, and so excited about this business, because it's a magnificent innovation to look at what's happened here. If you look at the regional area here with the Murray-Darling Basin Commission and the Howard government taking a lot of water out of the region, we ended up in a situation, so a lot of irrigation water was taken away for environmental flows. And so farmers had more land available than they could actually use for irrigation purposes. And so there's this magnificent infrastructure of all this laser-leveled land with power to the boundary of every property, water delivered to the boundary of every property, electricity. It's the perfect floodplain where the fish have lived for many, many millions of years. So it's the infrastructure and the environment were already here for it. And our guys have innovated by taking that native fish, placing it in an environment so similar to its native environment that it produces this beautiful quality product from land that previously wasn't being used.
My goodness, I think you've just covered all the questions I was going to ask you. What a fabulous story. Oh, my goodness, and how beautifully told too. Goodness, so feedstock, I was going to come to that further down the track, but gosh, you've just introduced it so fabulously. Thank you. Thank you, Ross. So just for listeners, the floodplain we're talking about, it's in the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Region, isn't it?
Yeah, the floodplain's in the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Region, but, you know, Australia has a very short history of white settlement. And effectively, before the Snowy Hydro Scheme was built in the Snowy Mountains up behind Canberra and in around Jindabyne, whenever there was rain on the mountains, there would be a flood event. So you wouldn't even need rain on the plains. Rain would occur on the mountains. The water would come racing down the river system and you would have water from Bourke to Shepparton. And these magnificent fish would live...
And to hay?
And to hay. And they were floodplains. You know, they were plains and they would end up with water all over them. The rivers would join. My parents talk about, you know, the rivers joining back in the great floods of the 1950s, and we've seen the 1974 floods, you know, around Wagga, where just vast areas of land were underwater. And they were all mitigated by the Snowy Hydro Scheme. Before that, there was nothing to stop that water just flowing down and spreading out across the landscape. And when it did, you know, the native fish, the Murray cod that would live right up underneath where the snow was melting at 5 or 6 degrees, they would wash out with those floods. And they'd come out into the overland floods and they'd end up in a puddle maybe the size of your room as the floods receded, and they'd have to wait for the next flood to take them back to the river. And they might be waiting there through a hot summer, and they've moved from 5 or 6 degrees water temperature to this muddy puddle at the back of Bourke somewhere, waiting and waiting for the next flood to move them back to the river. And they'd get water temperatures, you know, 28, 30 degrees and horrible water quality, and they would survive in that because they evolved to do that over 30 or 40 million years. And so what we've got is a fish that's actually perfect for aquaculture because it's got this huge temperature variation that it can handle, tolerate. And it also makes it a fabulous fish for aquaculture in that we're one of the only fish farmers in the world who don't use any antibiotics in our grow out systems. And the reason for that is during winter, the temperature of our ponds gets down to 9 or 10 degrees, which means most of the bugs that affect the fish won't survive below about 14 or 15 degrees. And so our fish come through and hit spring, you know, vibrant and healthy and clean and just, you know, grow with a lot of vigour. It makes it a really fantastic fish from an aquaculture point of view because they survive this beautiful water temperature variation.
And in a changing climate, changing conditions even more intensely, more regularly. I was speaking with David Crowe recently.
Yes.
About just these amazing fish and how incredible they are. And in particular, talking about them being such an ancient fish, like such an ancient fish, that they've actually lived, the species has lived through eras of climate change.
Yes.
It's fascinating.
They have. And they are an amazing fish. They lay down fat in a way that I haven't seen other fish do. You know, they'll lay down big layers of visceral fat inside their stomach cavity. And it makes them a fabulous cooking fish because, you know, you have all these beautiful gelatinous qualities coming through, full of omega-3s and 6s. Mm. And you have a fish on your plate that just doesn't dry out. And you have a fish that has a very mild taste. So they're just wonderful for that reason.
And do they like, you know, loaded question, I suppose, how can you tell? But what's your sense of how these amazing fish, ancient, often quite aggressive during the breeding season in the wild, I understand, full of character, full of, you know, amazing genetic memory. How do you think they like living in an aquacultural setting?
Well, I think they like it a lot better than they like living in a degraded Darling River system where they die without any oxygen and covered in blue-green algae.
Yeah.
So it becomes a very interesting question. What we've discovered is that when we put them together, they revert to a schooling mentality or a schooling behavior, which fish naturally do. You know, if you look at your nature documentaries or your David Attenborough videos on television, you'll see in the big wide ocean, the fish all school together. It's their habit and it's their nature.
Yeah.
And so we find that our fish have much better health, they feed better, they are less stressed when they're densely enough packed to be able to have a schooling behavior. If we leave them too far apart, they're probably a bit like humans. They become a bit territorial and quite aggressive with each other and as a result suffer quite badly. So we've, you know, and our vet has done a lot of work on this, and we think the stewardship and the care of our fish under our care is very important. And so we've actually studied this quite a lot, and we're putting obviously more work into it all the time because it's such a new industry. But seeing them in a schooling scenario, they seem much, much happier than they do when they're lonely and aggressive.
So interesting. I mean, they're probably incredibly intelligent fish too, aren't they? There's a whole sort of body of practice these days around recording the sounds of ecosystems and the sounds of rivers and the sounds of species. And I heard a great interview recently in which a young researcher was talking about her PhD recording, I can't remember what species, but fish in the oceans off the New South Wales coast to be able to tell when they want to mate and connect, and like this language of fish. That could be an exciting thing to look into as well.
Look, it could be. It's something that I certainly don't know anything about. It's probably more for our vets and our technical guys to talk about that.
I was going to ask you a question about vertical integration, and I think you've really covered a lot of that pretty well, haven't you? I was just wanting to draw out that the business started with those three different activities: silverwater native fish, the hatchery, Bidgee fish, the nursery, and Riverina aquaculture, the farm. And as you've said, you've already described how they came together, and Matt was very much a key person instigating each of those branches of the business. Are there any other sort of aspects of the vertical nature of the business that you'd just like to flag?
Look, one of the things that we've begun to do recently is bypass significantly reduce the amount of time in the nursery. And this has only been done for a couple of years now. So previously, you know, the established practice when we started from, you know, people like New South Wales Fisheries who'd done research on it and so on, was that you would hatch the fish, you would put them indoors in a nursery with controlled environment until they reached 100, 120, 30 grams in size, and then you would take them out to their grow out in an open pond. We found that when they moved from the nursery to the open grow out, they were very stressed. So they've lived all their lives. They've lived 6 or 7 months indoors in a controlled environment with no stress, you know, a bit like us living indoors and suddenly being taken out to live in a tent somewhere or sleep under the stars, we'd probably be a little bit stressed for a start. So what we've done is bypass that system to a degree where once they're hatched, they go through the nursery. So they'll be hatched at, you know, they come into the nursery at sort of 1 gram, spend a couple of weeks there. And in those couple of weeks, they might go out at, you know, 8 to 10 grams in size, and they go straight out to what we call our juvenile ponds. And so we've started this system of moving them straight out to the ponds at an earlier age. And what we're finding is we're getting better fish health, and particularly when they hit the following spring, they're much happier and better adjusted, if you like, than the fish coming out of the dark, warm nursery into the spring ponds are very stressed and go off their feed. And we've developed this system now of just bringing them through smoothly all the way through the ponds. From a vertical integration point of view, it's actually sped the process up a fraction. It's sped the process up in terms of getting them out to ponds, but they do grow a little slower in the ponds for that first 6 months, and because the water temperature is a bit colder.
But that's incredibly innovative. Are people doing similar things overseas?
I don't know.
I was going to ask you about some of the most innovative, outstanding achievements so far, and I think you've touched on quite a number of them already. Would you like to, you know, hatchery, breeding, spawning in captivity, what are the best conditions, like you've just described, for a comfortable transition into the ponds, the grow-out ponds and so forth? What about, and you alluded to feedstocks and that's one area you possibly might continue further work on or that's a focus. So what do Murray cod traditionally eat in the wild and what do they currently eat within Acuna's production system? Is that confidential or can you tell us what they eat?
No, we're very happy to talk about anything. We have complete transparency in our business. So the first thing is what they eat in the wild. I've been told the big ones will eat wild ducks off the surface.
Predatory.
they are the alpha predator in the river system, and they would eat whatever they could, depending on their size, and they would even eat each other. So the big ones would eat the little ones if they could catch them. In our system, we've been feeding them a diet produced by the large feed producers based in Tasmania. There are basically three large feed producers of aquaculture feed in Australia, Skretting's, Biomar and Ridley's. And we haven't been able to get transparency or good enough transparency on the diets. And so we've begun work with a Japanese company that has some excellent natural technologies. You know, they use the extracts of tree bark to promote fish health. They have a number of things that are really positive ways of promoting the health and the growth of the fish in using very natural ingredients. So we've actually begun a project where we've commissioned what we call our vegan diet. I don't know that that's the right way to call it, but what it effectively means is that we have a diet formulated for us at the moment, which is made entirely of plant-based proteins. So we analyzed the amino acids in the previous diet, and we've replaced it with plant-based proteins. We're doing a trial with Deakin University now to see how that impacts on fish growth, fish health, and of course, fish taste. And we'll have more information for you on that in, 6 months or so. But at this stage, that's where we're looking to go. We want to have complete transparency and traceability in everything we do. And the one area where we don't have enough control at the moment is in the feed. And so we're working to change that as fast as we can.
How interesting. And in terms of scaling, like that's going to be something that becomes more and more focal.
Yeah, as we scale, it becomes much simpler for us. We were so small to begin with. You know, the big food producers just said, oh, look, we're not going to make anything for Murray cod. We'll just give you the barramundi diet.
Has the team also been working on breeding and producing other freshwater fish species, given this incredible knowledge and depth and incredible environmental ecological contribution the business is making? Are you also producing other freshwater fish?
At our hatcheries, we produce golden perch, silver perch and Murray cod. Those go out as fingerlings for the New South Wales, Victorian and South Australian fisheries to restock rivers and dams. But from a grow-out perspective, we're focusing at this stage completely on Murray cod. We did do a trial with some golden perch,
mm-hmm.
who are just a magnificent eating fish.
I'm told they are.
They're just absolutely magnificent to eat. But if you're going to be successful as a company and do something really well, you need to have a narrow focus for a start. So we're going to focus entirely on perfecting what we do with Acuna Sustainable Murray Cod. And once we've got that, we may look at Acuna Sustainable Golden Perch. There's nothing to stop us, looking at other high-quality species to do things with. But let's take one step at a time. And as I say, we've just gone from startup to adolescence.
So the golden and silver perch, in a sense, they're an ecological services business. You're currently selling them to replenish ecological stocks, as you've just...
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
That's so exciting. Gosh, you've already mentioned Matthew Ryan and his incredible background and how he started this whole fabulous enterprise. Can you tell me a bit more about the other... I don't know, a bit more about the team more generally, the culture of the place, and there's an incredible vibe going on and I understand you've got a big focus on inclusivity and lots of amazing women in high-level roles and things. Would you like to talk about the culture of the place?
Yeah, look, the culture is that whoever can do a job is the one who does it. We're not interested in creed, colour, sex or anything else. We've always operated on the basis of who's the best quality person to do something. And that's on our ponds, in our management team, wherever we operate. It's never really been an issue for us, for myself. You know, I've been in business for 30 years and I think I've had a team of ladies who've been in senior positions in that business for 26 or 27 of those years. So from that perspective, it operates really well. We really look for people who think outside the box and who want to innovate, but still have a commercial edge to that innovation. You know, we're so young that we can't afford to make big mistakes. We can make some little ones, and we operate on the premise that if you don't make a few mistakes, you're not taking enough risk. But we have a really inclusive team, young people coming through. One of the things that you find out here is nobody had ever grown Murray Cod before. So we've had an enormous training component to our business in the last 5 years, building teams. We've had people come across from the chicken industry who have been great because they understand biosecurity, they understand, you know, protein production, but they've been learning a lot about fish. And we have some incredible young men and women who are, you know, building themselves into quite senior positions in the company simply because there's nobody else to do it. In inland aquaculture, there's been nobody in Australia doing it. So these guys are learning and developing and moving into running the company as we move along, which is fabulous.
And Murray Cod are culturally and ecologically, you know, deeply important species and part of Aboriginal culture. Do you have what are your sort of connections with the local Aboriginal community and employees and so forth?
Look, at a personal level, I grew up, you know, living in the Aboriginal communities of Darlington Point and around that area and playing footy with a lot of those boys, and so understand, and fishing with them and so on. So from that perspective, you know, we've got great personal connections. At a company level, we want to be inclusive for all people. Mm. So, you know, recreational fishers, of whom the Indigenous community are many, we sponsor fishing competitions. We restock a lot of fish for fishing clubs up and down the river system within the Murray-Darling Basin. And our focus is that, you know, we'll work with anyone in the community who wants to promote the species and promote the health of the Murray-Darling Basin.
Has there been any pushback from Aboriginal people to what you're doing?
No, none whatsoever. Everybody's happy that there are more fish in the river.
I had to ask.
You know, 20 years ago, you struggled, 20, 25 years ago, you struggled to catch a Murray cod in the Murrumbidgee. But if you go out there now, you'll catch five or six in an afternoon.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And these amazing fish, an average age in the wild, when they were endemic in the wild, could have been something like until almost about 50 years old, and quite common to be 15, 20 years old, and obviously different weights at different ages. What's the sort of age bracket that you're producing your Murray cod for before they go to sale?
It's interesting because we're different consumers like different sized fish. So our Asian people of Asian heritage tend to like a plate-sized fish that they can steam. Mm. And so they might be, you know, they might be an 800 to sort of 1.2 kilo fish. The high-end Western-style restaurants tend to like larger fish, 3 kilos plus, where they can take the fillet and the loins, and they tend to do things with the bones. And, you know, guys like Josh Nyland are using the whole fish. So those top-end chefs are really using the whole fish and working with them in all sorts of ways. But for us, there's a variety of sizes that we send them out to market. Where that ends up and where the bulk of it ends up, you know, we've only been going 5 years, so we don't know. The fish themselves are extremely high quality flesh at 3 kilos, where we sell a lot of them.
How old am I as a Murray cod to be 3 kilos?
Anywhere from 2 to 4 years old. So the population is a bit like humans. You know, we have big ones and little ones. So within the same pen, there may be some that are, you know, 3.5 to 4 kilos. And within that same pen, there may be some that are, you know, 1.5 to 2.5 kilos. They vary in a fairly normal population distribution, just like anybody else. And the reason for that is they're still pretty much a wild population. You know, we haven't done any selective breeding or anything with them to any great extent yet.
Interesting. So a four-year-old fish, that's a very valuable, a premium valuable animal on a whole lot of levels, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Most of them are about 3 years old at that, you know, at that level.
Aquaculture is one of the fastest growing food producing industries in the world. It's a key and growing source of protein for many people around the world. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, global aquaculture production rose 520% for the period 1990 to 2018. That's from data from 2020.
That would be right.
It's amazing, isn't it? And some 54% of seafood consumed worldwide is produced through aquaculture, but approximately 87% of seafood fish purchased in New South Wales is imported. Now, I'm not sure if that includes fresh fish. I should have checked that. But either way, there are enormous domestic and export opportunities for sustainably produced high-quality fish. Ross, tell us about what, as you keep saying, you're an adolescent on the, you know, rapidly growing and clever and precocious and lots of integrity and sustainability. So it's so exciting. And who knows, the world's your oyster probably. But what are the sorts of production goals for Acuna, say, by 2030?
Oh, look, we're on track to produce 10,000 tonnes of Acuna Murray cod by the year 2030. When we listed 4 years ago, I think we had about 40 tonnes of productive capacity, and we had effectively two ponds in production. Today we've got 34 ponds in production. We'll be consistently adding, and there's about 8 or 9 contract grower.
So you started with 2 and you now have 34 ponds. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's been good growth. But it's sustainable growth. You can't have companies that grow too quickly. And the biggest problem, you know, a lot of companies grow too quickly and run out of cash. Our biggest issue is actually having enough high quality people to grow and maintain the safety and the quality environment for the fish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's one of our limiting factors. And I swear it's probably one of our biggest limiting factors going forward.
Oh, that's a call out.
And I think it's an Australian problem in general.
Ross, we've already touched on what an incredibly high value quality fish in terms of texture and taste, and that world leading chefs really esteem and look to Murray cod as one of the top sorts of products they like to work with. Where do you see the key markets currently being, and where do you see the greatest growth potential, perhaps nationally and or internationally?
Nationally, most people don't know the fish, the species.
I was going to ask that. Yeah, I only learned about it 5 years ago.
And those who do, you know, in the 1880s through to about World War One, it was the most widely consumed fish in Melbourne. The port of Moama has records that they alone sent 450 tonnes down in the year 1883, you know, they've got records of Murray cod, 450 tonnes being shipped down from Moama. So there was anything from 1 to 2,000 tonne a year, we estimate, being consumed in Melbourne through those years. With the advent of overfishing, the introduction of the Murray-Darling scheme, and then redfin, a species from Europe who are very aggressive little fish, and then followed by the European carp, the species suffered enormously and they became an endangered species some time ago. For us to see them going forward, you know, our key markets, obviously we're getting great reception in Europe. We're getting a fabulous reception in the US. Japan was really keen on them prior to the COVID lockdown, and the Japanese actually came out here to do their due diligence on the farming practices about 3 days before they had to scurry out of the country for lockdowns. And so we haven't done much with the Japanese since. We sent our first order back to Japan about a week or so ago, but only on a small scale. But because of its high fat content and its really creamy texture, it's a very high quality smoked product. And so in Europe, there's about 300,000 tons a year of smoked fish consumed. That's almost all pink fleshed fish. Salmon and trout. There's not a lot of offerings of high quality white flesh smoked fish, particularly not, you know, with the gelatinous content that we've got. So, you know, if we picked up half a percent or 1% of that market, if we picked up 1% of that market, for example, that's 3,000 tons of smoked fish going out, which equates to 9,000 tons of fresh fish, because by the time you fillet it and then you smoke it, you end up with about 30% of the weight. So, That's a real area of growth for us in a high value added area. We've been doing work with Josh Nyland, and we'll be making some more announcements on this later in the year about value adding many of the offcuts of the fish and how we deal with that and what products we can put out there that are available for everyday people. And the other aspect that, you know, I'd really like it to be introduced to all Australians.
Yeah.
You know, I've got the Weet-Bix phenomenon. You know, as a child, I was brought up eating Weet-Bix and Milo and Vegemite, the Australian products. Now, if I go somewhere for breakfast and things are a little bit unfamiliar, I'll eat a bit of Weet-Bix. What we're looking to do is introduce products over the next couple of years that will be available for young people to eat fish. You know, very few children are promoted to eat fish. The scientific research shows the benefits for children's health, both mentally and physically, when they're eating more seafood. We really want to push that as a product that they like, because we find that kids really like the taste of this fish. If we have, you know, I know if we have a barbecue and our smoked fish are on a platter, it tends to disappear with 3 to 7 year olds just racing over and picking it off the plate while the adults aren't noticing. So one of our focuses is to introduce it to Australians and from a long-term basis to have them understand that a kuna is a product that's good for them and will be around for them for the future, for many years to come.
Oh my goodness, there's a whole amazing product opportunity there to compete with fish paste and Vegemite, you know, healthy stock.
Yeah, look, it'll never be cheap. It'll never be a cheap product. It's a high quality product, and as a result, it won't be something that'll be accessible, you know, really easily from a price point of view. But when you look at the health benefits and the taste benefits and the sustainability around it, it'll be worth it for mums and dads to be purchasing this for their kids.
High quality fish pastes and fish sauces that you know don't have high levels of mercury or other problematic things in them, I think people would be prepared to pay for them as part of a more plant-based diet. They're a really key base flavour. Really interesting.
You know, ultimately, if we're going to improve the health of our society, we have to.
In other reports and on your website, you talk about food service and retail, supermarkets, exports, value-adding. As you said, you've got some announcements coming around value-adding to offcuts of the whole fish. That's all very exciting. We'll stay tuned for that. And you've mentioned your relationship with Josh Nyland. And if you go to Akuna's website, you'll see there are relationships with Hester Blumenthal and various other amazing chefs, international chefs and local high-end chefs. What about, you touched on COVID impacting on the market with Japan. Has COVID and the recent long, cool summer impacted on the business in other ways?
Oh, look, COVID had a significant impact on us. We were beginning to put fish into supermarkets when COVID hit, in the middle of it. And as a result, you know, we couldn't do taste testing. We couldn't have people in, you know, one of the things that sells this fish is that we give people a taste and then they want it and they buy it. We were unable to do that. Through the supermarkets, they had real logistical issues with staffing shortages and through their distribution centres. So we were unable to get into the distribution centres we needed to get fish on the shelves. So we were getting constant feedback from customers through our social media sites saying, we want this fish, but we can't get it. You said it's in Woolworths at such and such, and we can't get it.
Yeah.
Why isn't it there? And it was more around the logistics of, you know, just what was happening in society at that time,
yeah,
which was an issue for us. Of course, many restaurants suffered significantly. So the first 5 months of this financial year, we reported for the 6 months, I think we were 29% ahead of the previous year on sales, but that was still a long way behind where we expected to be. Thankfully, in the last few months, it's been a very different environment in Australia and demand for our product's been very high.
Does it have a niche role in the sort of sashimi market?
Yeah, Japanese are using it for sashimi. And we do have a number of restaurants in Sydney and Melbourne beginning to trial it as sashimi as well. I have an interesting story of when we first went to the Japanese, the Tokyo Seafood Show a couple of years back, pre-COVID, and we cut up thousands and thousands of pieces of sashimi. But the Japanese people really, really liked it. It's one of the only freshwater fish that they can use as sashimi, because over there they have microbes that actually live in the water, which make freshwater fish unsuitable for sashimi products, for raw fish products, but we don't have that in our water.
Mm.
And so they're really keen on it from that perspective. Certainly we've got a few in LA and the US looking, using it as sashimi now as well.
And that'd be really high premium pricing, wouldn't it?
Look, it's not, probably not as high as it should be, Anthea. given the quality and the taste of it.
Yeah, fabulous. That's so interesting in terms of biosecurity issues. I know I was at the NFF conference recently and they were talking about, you know, there's always biosecurity issues on the horizon as COVID and many other things have highlighted. But that's one of the big strengths of healthy Australian waters or enclosed aquaculture systems is being able to maintain that purity.
Being able to work on the water quality is one of the great innovations that our guys have been able to put in place, and it impacts, you know, the health of the fish, the quality of the fish, and the whole grow out cycle. It's a fabulous way they do it.
There's a very good infographic on Acuna's website for anyone who'd like to visit it that sets out really comprehensively the sorts of achievements and goals that the business has been hitting in terms of sustainability. Ross, you've already touched on a lot of these issues already, but I just thought I'd just spell them out. The website talks about how the business each year sets out tangible targets to reduce environmental impacts across the vertically integrated business. And there are four specific areas of focus: water use, energy consumption, feed management, and wild fish populations. You've already spoken about how you've released 23 million fingerlings back into the wild. That's absolutely incredible. And we've spoken about feed management. We've spoken about new feed sources. Do you want to talk about feed management issues at all in terms of sustainability, continuous improvement or issues you're working on, or have you covered that?
Well, I think we've covered it to a degree. One of the issues that is obvious for the aquaculture industry is the use of fish meal. And it's something that a lot of people, you know, either skirt past, or some people focus on it really heavily and other people try to hide away from it. You know, we're currently still having to use fish meal in our diet because we're buying a commercial diet from manufacturers where we don't have the buying power to dictate what we want. Our aim is to end up with a diet that contains no fish meal. I don't see it as a sustainable industry if you're taking, you know, 1.5 kilos of fish meal out of the ocean to produce 1.2 kilos of fish in an aquaculture system. It's just robbing Peter to pay Paul from an environmental perspective. So we're not there yet, but it's something we're working on. We've got our research happening with Deakin now.
Yep.
And we'll say, watch this space.
That is so interesting because also Acuna Sustainable Murray Cod is listed as green in the Good Fish Guide, and that's the highest rating you can get. And from Good Fish, they speak about the amount of wild caught fish needed to produce fish meal and oil for Murray Cod is roughly equivalent or less than the amount of farm fish produced. This means that the farms aren't taking out more fish from the ocean than they produce, which is what you've just spoken about.
We're at that point now, but we want to get to the point where we take no wild fish. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't elaborate on our own system. We are certainly using less wild fish in our diet than we're producing, which is, you know, a positive for the environment, for human consumption. But we will aim to get that down to zero.
And water use and water recycling. I think you've mentioned how you're using infrastructure that was no longer being used but was in place in terms of the laser cleared infrastructure and fields and ponds and what have you. And the water in the ponds is kept very, very clean and recycled and reticulated numerous times, is that right? But then ultimately at some stage it can be used in other forms of agriculture productively.
Yes, eventually when the water, you know, if we put some fresh water into the ponds, we obviously take some of the older water out, and that is often nutrient enriched with nitrites and some of the fish waste. And farmers can use that on their crops on the adjoining fields. And, you know, it lowers their fertilizer levels. It provides them with a really good usable level of organic fertilizers dissolved in the water already, which is great for them.
Yeah. And during COVID also, I understand you were participating in a food bank for Sydney initiative that employed out-of-work hospitality workers. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, we did for a while. Yes. Yeah, we were providing some fish for that. Yeah, it was a real positive for us, and it's good to do those types of things.
So you're an absolute leader in the industry and in the local Griffith community and environment. You're employing people in clever jobs. You're, you know, using water in closed loops, and you're supporting other agriculture as part of the sustainability and circular resource use in the system. Any other comments about what Acuna currently does in and with the community or might be planning for the future?
Look, one of the big things is building the skill base in the community. And, you know, taking a young person who doesn't have those skills, teaching them, training them, developing them, giving them a sense of responsibility and growth. And, you know, that's all a positive for the community when you've got a community that's got high levels of employment and high levels of skilled people coming through who also begin to look outside their own little pocket. You know, they see that our fish are going to Japan or to Europe or to the US, so they understand the connectivity in the world. And I think it just broadens people's outlook and generally leads to a better vibe and a better standard of living, you know, socially and economically within the whole community.
Of course, seeing an amazing business like Akuna, it suddenly makes it much more easy to understand when you're at school why you focus on science or biology or marketing or whatever it might be. Like it's really inspirational and tangible for kids in your town and community, isn't it? It's very exciting.
Yeah, it is. And we get kids, you know, we've had some who've come out as school leavers or even after school doing work, you know, on the ponds or around the fish farm, and you know, they become really involved in it. So it's a great scenario. We've got, you know, one who came as on a gap year from university, you know, was going to go to university, never ended up going, is actually doing uni by correspondence now and continuing to work in the business and taking high levels of responsibility. So,
yeah, one of the advantages of COVID, we all learn online now.
Yeah, and we've got, you know, we've got some great young people coming through who are going to be future leaders in this industry and in this community.
You've already spoken about the incredible contribution of contributing fingerlings back into the ecosystem. I was going to have a long-winded question about that, but I think we've covered it quite well. But I did want to ask you for your personal reflections or comments upon the fish kills of 2018 and 19 and also into 2020. They were due to many things, and we could talk about the Murray-Darling irrigation water scheme and the drought and all the rest. Drought, algal blooms, sudden temperature drops, bushfire runoff where that applied, and sudden changes in water quality following rain are some of the many causes or drivers.
Contributors, yep.
Contributors. Would you like to comment on that further or any personal reflections from what you saw?
Look, it's not, I don't have the personal knowledge and I wasn't in the area to make personal comment on what happened there or why it happened. What I can say is that when it occurred, we had some spare aerators that we put on trucks and took over to Menindi for the government to use and the local people to use in trying to maintain some of the health of the fish, oxygen, re-oxygenate the water. The other thing we did was go over and help harvest some of those large fish that were at extreme risk, and obviously some of them ended up dying.
Wow.
Over there. But we harvested some which we brought back to our hatchery. We've segregated them and we've begun breeding from them, and we'll be returning some of those fingerlings to the Darling River as the government feels there's enough water and it's a safe enough situation for those fish to go back in.
It's amazing. So it's helping sustain the numbers but helping sustain the genetic diversity as well.
Absolutely.
Heading towards a bit of a wrap perhaps and thinking about land-based aquaculture in Australia and looking to the future, what do you see as the big challenges to growth in the sector here?
The single biggest challenge we face is finding enough people. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're seeing that in regional Australia, we're seeing that across every industry that I talk to. It's a major challenge in Australia. So finding people, developing them, training them and retaining them is probably the biggest challenge we face. We have the system of growing them. Our guys have really great innovations occurring, which are improving the way the fish live and grow and breed. But the people side of it is probably the biggest challenge we'll face.
Are there dedicated aquaculture sort of courses or?
Yes, there are. And we've been putting a number of staff, you know, we've been sponsoring a number of staff to go through those. Mm-hmm. And we spend a lot of time, our senior people spend a lot of time, you know, training and developing the other people in the company.
And what and where do you perhaps see the really big opportunities for business, healthy food, and perhaps for local communities more generally? I mean, those are challenges, but the really big, where do you see the big opportunities being? Is it through a geographic lens or new species lens or
this is for us or for farm agriculture in general or
for land-based aquaculture in general and then also for you specifically?
Look, land-based aquaculture is a great system of production. I've been in agribusiness for 30 years and it's probably the best agribusiness I've ever seen. It's just fabulous. It produces a beautiful, high-quality product.
Mm.
I think one of the things where we're able to really capitalise is that we produce a luxury product, not a commodity. So, you know, you spoke earlier in your introduction about the salmon industry, and I don't have any knowledge and wouldn't be appropriate for me to make any comment about a lot of the stuff that Richard Flanagan's written about. But what I can talk about is that we are not a commodity. You know, the salmon industry in Norway produces somewhere up around 1 million tons a year. The South Americans produce hundreds of thousands of tons. Russia, Alaska, Canada, they all have a huge wild catch of salmon.
Mm.
So salmon, as an example, is a commodity. If somebody wants to charge too much for it, the buyers will buy it from somewhere else. Barramundi, you know, Barramundi is another example. Last numbers I looked at, there was about 22,000 ton consumed in Australia every year. Of that, 2,000 ton was wild caught, beautiful saltwater fish. 5,000 ton was farmed in Australia, and 15,000 tons of barramundi came in from Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam, and so on. And again, that turns it back to a commodity-based product. So 3/4 of our iconic Australian barramundi that we're eating actually aren't even produced or harvested in Australia. Murray cod, not only does it not grow anywhere else in the world, it doesn't even grow anywhere else in Australia. It only grows in the Murray-Darling Basin. It's an endangered species, so there's no wild catch to compete with. And effectively, at this stage, there are no other producers of any significant scale anywhere in the world. So we have what you probably call a niche luxury product. It's very beautiful product, you know, beautiful fish to eat. And as a result, you know, we're in a really great position with it. If you looked at something like Patagonian toothfish, I think the licenses for that are about 35,000 ton a year. And it's a magnificent fish, sells at very high prices, you know, across the US and even within Australia. So if we get to 10,000 tons, we're still only 1/3 of the volumes of a very rare fish like Patagonian toothfish. But it's a fish grown in Antarctica in very cold waters and has a wild catch and all the ecological and sustainability issues that they need to manage carefully around that. With us, we have abundant land, abundant water, and there's a magnificent opportunity for us to continue to produce this magnificent luxury food product.
In the Murray-Darling Basin.
Mm.
I was going to ask if you'll be exporting any Griffith homegrown smarts anytime soon overseas, but I think you've answered that. Any further thoughts, final comments you'd like to make?
Not really. I mean, it's a magnificent product. Our four pillars of, you know, quality, sustainability, innovation and integrity are what drive our company. And we won't flinch away from any of those. As you go along, as we go along, we'll obviously have challenges and hurdles that we have to overcome and things that pop up that we don't expect. But that's part of every new industry. And the team of people we have, really clever, open-minded, broad thinking, have so far overcome all of the challenges that we've faced. And, you know, we see a lot of blue sky ahead for this company and this iconic fish for the world to consume.
And you're working with amazing other businesses and chefs and partners. So it's just going to be incredible to watch over the years ahead. Ross, thanks so much for speaking with me, and all power to you and all of the team at Acuna. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Anthea.
I've been speaking with Ross Anderson, who is the chair of Acuna Sustainable Murray Cod, a really inspiring Australian land-based aquaculture business who produce delicious Murray Cod for people and, as part of that picture, are making a huge contribution to restore stocks of this ancient, culturally and ecologically highly significant fish along the way. To learn more, head to Acuna's website at acuna.com. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anthea.
Thanks for listening. To listen to more episodes of Nourishing Matters to Chew On, head to Foodswell's podcast page at foodswell.org.au/nourishing or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And stay in touch via Instagram at @nourishing_matters and on Facebook at Nourishing Matters to Chew On. If you like what you hear and would like to support us, give us a rating and a review in your favourite podcast app so other people can find us too. Nourishing Matters to Chew On is proud to be on the Climactic Network of podcasts and part of a collective of podcasters dedicated to inspiring positive action around climate change. Check out the other great podcasts on the Climactic Network at www.climactic.fm.